Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Welcome our listeners to Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. Last week we missed having you to join our program. We had some technical difficulties. We were supposed to have as our guest Al Suarez to speak on some very important issues in regards to many of the current world events. Has the empire reached beyond its limits, and how should we remember 9/11 or September the 11th, 2001? And Al, once again, I would like to thank you for joining the program. I know much of this was on short notice, but thanks for joining the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Al, you know, you have quite a few listeners out there, people that like to keep up with you, and I just want to mention you really add a lot to this program. I've been noticing the boost, how many people have been sharing our program through the Internet as a result of you joining the program on a regular basis. And I want to thank you for what you bring to the table, the information and the knowledge that you share with many of the people that share the same concerns that we have. Thanks again for that. Al, today, as I mentioned, we're discussing, has the empire reached its limits, and how should we remember 9/11? But first, we're going to talk about the empire. I think when we understand about the empire, we're talking about the U.S. empire. The empire of this nation has actually expanded to every corner of the globe, and we can see that we brought in a president in 2008 that said he was going to end the wars within 9 months of his office. He was going to create jobs at home. He was going to put our youth to work. He was going to take care of the seniors. He was going to build the infrastructure. And within the last 6 years that this president has been in office, we have seen ourselves on a continuous escalation of conflicts throughout the world. And we, as I mentioned, we have expanded even more so to every corner of the globe. We see ourselves going into the Middle East more, to a greater extent than what we saw under the previous president, George Bush. We have seen ourselves moving into South Asia, and we have seen ourselves moving throughout the continent of Europe. But we have seen that this country, they elected a president that has created more conflicts and has taken the reins of power to drag this nation into further war. But Al, I want to, the direction that we're going to take today is, have we reached beyond our limits to control all of these areas that we are involved in? In my opinion, Al, we're greatly extended. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about what we're doing, what this nation is doing in regards to building their military influence throughout the world. But Al, what is your opinion about the breadth that this nation has moved, the direction that they have moved in regards to expanding their military and also the limits of their power?
Well, the United States has constantly had military interventions, at least since the 1970s. So this is an ongoing thing that Obama's inherited and to an extent has expanded upon. And, you know, this is our first program since 9/11, and I know we're going to talk about that towards the end of the program, but if you didn't mind, I wanted to read a brief quote that kind of answers to what you were saying and mentions 9/11, so I'll go ahead and read it. It says, so let's imagine how the U.S. September 11th attacks could have been worse, for example. Suppose that on September 11th, Al-Qaeda had bombed the White House and killed the president, instituted a murderous, brutal regime which killed maybe 50,000 to 100,000 people and tortured about 700,000, set up a major international terrorist center in Washington, which was overthrowing governments all over the world, and installing brutal, vicious neo-Nazi dictatorships, assassinating people. Suppose he called in a bunch of economists, let's call them the Kandahar Boys, to run the American economy, who within a couple of years had driven the economy into one of the worst collapses of its history. Suppose this had happened. That would have been worse than 9/11, right? But it did happen, and it happened on 9/11. That happened on September 11th, 1973 in Chile. Well, people don't talk about that. We did it. Noam Chomsky.
Mm-hmm. And Al, as you had mentioned, you know, what we have done, what we did in Chile, what we have done in many other parts of the globe, you know, this is ongoing. One of the things I was reading today, and Al, we have to consider the cost. It's way beyond what is costing American taxpayers. Many times when we talk about these wars and we talk about these conflicts throughout the globe, we say that this is costing American tax dollars. But Al, you know, people can't fathom. They can't fathom the cost that it is creating such a financial burden on this nation to be able to fund all these conflicts. I was just reading something recently. We see that the national debt, I shouldn't say the debt, but as far as the debt limit for this country, they are looking at raising the limit, and presently it's right at around $16 billion. But we see James Hamilton, he's with the University of California in San Diego, and he says when we look at the debt, he is estimating that debt is $70 trillion, Al. $70 trillion. So people can understand, maybe where people can understand what $70 trillion is, I'm going to break it down in some numbers that maybe we can understand. If you look at every man, woman, and child in this country, every man, woman, and child, just to pay the debt where it's at today, everyone would have to pay $230,000. Everyone. If you're in this country, you have to pay $230,000. That's not even talking about the interest on that debt. That's $230,000.
That's including children, every man, woman, and child, right?
Exactly. Every man, woman, and child.
Of all countries, right?
Now, what has happened, Al, is the debt and the burden of that debt has grown so much because of our military interventions, the way mm-hmm. that we have been expanding globally.
Yeah.
It is beyond the budget that we can afford as a nation. Presently, this country on defense, military spending is approximately $650 billion. But when you consider defense spending for this country, we're spending $1.5 trillion a year on just defense spending. That's not even taking care of other things, budgetary
items. More than any other country's military budget. I believe if you combine all the other countries' military budget together, it doesn't come to what the United States is. And in the past 10, 15 years, the military budget went from 30% of the national budget to at least 60% now of the national budget. So it's literally doubled.
We spend $688 billion a year just on military spending. That's not even defense. That's just
Martin
the military.
Luther King warned about this in the late 60s during Vietnam. He said, you know, now, more and more money is going to war and not to social programs to help the poor. That column since the late 60s has only been on the increase because of U.S. foreign policy. It's imperialism.
Now what is taking place here, we can see that the country has expanded to the point of the military. We have presently over 750 military bases and outposts around the world. We're expanding in many countries as far as with drone attacks, operations to overthrow governments. Al, it has grown at such a rapid pace that the current budget of this country, our budget, cannot sustain that. So right now when you hear about $16 trillion, Al, the real number is around $70 trillion. that this country is in debt. It's gotten to the point where they can't even talk about it because we have to protect the capitalist economy worldwide. It is doing it on the backs of this nation, this country. We have become the military might to help to sustain capitalism. But Al, I don't see where, when I look at history, when I look at the Romans, when I looked at other empires of the past, you can even go back 3,000 years, other empires of the past, it's unsustainable because eventually your wealth becomes worthless, like this country right here. What are your ideas, your thoughts in regards to that, Al?
Could you repeat the question?
In regards to what I'm saying is when you look at the way that we're expanding beyond our limits as a nation, mm-hmm. is very similar to what we could see with other empires of the past, whether we go to the Persian Empire, whether we go to the Babylonian Empire, if we go to even Great Britain, they had an empire at the turn of the Revolutionary War. We saw the same thing throughout time, but the U.S. is following the same pattern where they're, even when you look at the finances, we are extending beyond our limits, and then we're going to speak a little bit about what took place in Germany.
Yeah, I mean, the guy who wrote Art of War, that Chinese tactician, he said, you know, when war happens, you know, the domestic, you know, programs for the people, that they suffer, you know, and that's been true since, you know, ancient China. I mean, and you know, so it's war itself has consequences at home, you know, and a lot of people say, well, look at World War II. I mean, preceding World War I, the Depression happened, but World War II is kind of the opposite, and that's true because the Japanese and German competitors were decimated, so the United States pretty much had a monopoly and helped rebuild Europe. But all of the United States' competitors after the Second World War had declined, so the United States had this superiority and this boost that benefited their economy into the 50s. But by the 80s, capitalism, you know, ruined that. But, you know, that was an exception because usually when countries take part in a war, even the victors suffer. You know, there's economic consequences from that war. And that plunder that they take from the war goes to the elites. You know,
right.
It doesn't go to,
exactly.
to trickle down to the rest of the populace, you know.
Very good point.
We do have a caller. Al, this is one of your co-hosts, 727.
Actually,
yeah,
Al is my
Chris.
Co-host. but yes, this is Chris. I've called in before to this exact
Hi, Chris.
Show. Yeah,
yeah, you've been our guest before.
In,
I appreciate it.
We
yeah,
did our first
before
show.
You changed your name. Back when I was the Socialist Insider.
Right.
Once back then. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it was important what you're talking about is that there is no victors in war either side. You know, if the United States and Russia were to go to war one day, the Russian people nor the American people would win out. In fact, the only people that win out in a war are the top bankers, the people who loan the money to both sides and made the war possible. And
exactly.
Also the corporate CEOs that make the bombs. I mean,
everybody's looking if there's nuclear war, but yeah, if it's just you know, war with other weapons, then you know, in the end, the bankers will win out because they bet on both sides.
Yeah, unless it's a nuclear war, which you know the bankers are going to make sure that's not the case, or that's not the case because they don't want to get blown up as well. They're going to make the war can get as bad as it can get as long as nukes are not involved because they know once that happens, then it'll be what they call mad scenario, mutual assured destruction.
And then what Einstein said, that we'll be fighting with sticks and stones, right? The World War IV.
it would just take another couple hundred years, and then there'd be more people that'd be like, hey, look, we got guns again. Now let's sell them to each side of the war. You know, there'd be people profiting off of selling stones. I mean, people are going to profit off of war, unfortunately. War, it's a racket. It's I think there was one of the guys, a World War I vet said that.
Smedley Butler, General Smedley Butler. He was a hero and against war.
Chris brought up a very important point because he mentioned about how the bankers, how they financed both sides. If we look at the Germans during World War II and also World War One, the bankers actually financed the military industrialization of Germany. Actually, they even did that during World War One, preceding. And when you looked at the rebuilding of Germany, the banks put billions of dollars into building the military might of Germany.
Oh, big time.
Right. And then Germany, after they had spent billions building that, Germany was they realized that they were on the verge of financial bankruptcy. They were building at a pace that was unsustainable. So subsequently what happened is Germany had to expand their sphere of influence by starting to the countries that were around them. They start on a quest, starting with Poland and even reaching out to Russia to be able to expand their global sphere of influence at that time, because economically the country was on the verge of collapse. Now we can see, Chris, that we are following in the same path that what happened in Germany. We are and also Al, when you look at how we have overspent, now we are trying to maintain controls of the people of the world and the economies of the world by force, by militaries, by police departments. We can see that that is happening worldwide. So basically you see the same thing. If you go all the way from the Romans 2,000 years ago and you come to the present day, and well, if you go back to the Germans 80 years ago and you look at today, we're following the same path of empires of yesteryear.
Well, yeah, I heard that ISIS has been declared the richest terror group in history, $3 million a day. You know, these are what these guys are getting, and, you know, they're still there. You know,
where's the money coming from?
Syria, but, yeah, where's
coming
the money coming from?
From the CIA,
they say they're from
States.
Human trafficking, from Saudi Arabia, or as Chris just said, I don't know if directly or indirectly, but they're saying the CIA helped in financing
and
training
in
Syria.
And indirectly. Both ways.
Now, let me ask you, when you talk about ISIS, where are these rebels, where are they coming from?
Libya, Saudi Arabia, Qatar.
Are any
some
of them coming from Saudi Arabia?
Some of them are Syrian and Iraqi, but a lot of them are actually foreigners. I mean, they're coming from other Arab countries, but they're not indigenous to the area necessarily.
And there's a lot of British
lot of
in
them.
There, too. I mean, there's British,
so
British
with Arab backgrounds.
Mostly they're mercenaries.
Pakistani.
Yeah, there's some British, there's even some Americans that have been found working with the ISIS.
Now, who is putting, in your opinion, Al and Chris, who's putting up all the money for these terror groups?
Right now it's Qatar, and they're getting their money from the United States government. Qatar is still contributing a lot of money into ISIS, and the United States is quiet about it, because I think the United States is using ISIS as a big ploy to attack Assad. Honestly, I think that they don't want to eliminate ISIS off the face of the planet. They do want to get rid of Assad because that interferes with their Middle Eastern agenda, and it's also in the way of a major pipeline. You know, they want
the persecution of the family of the American journalists held by ISIS if they tried to negotiate. They wanted them dead at all costs so that they could justify an invasion. So all efforts to negotiate, do prisoner exchange or some, you know, move money around or whatever to get them released, the U.S. government threatened them with persecution. And the same so-called moderates in Syria are the ones that sold Sotloff, the second American that was killed. They sold them to the more radical group, to ISIS. So, you know, this is how they're showing their appreciation. You know, these people
are
cutthroat. Assad is more stable.
Two questions I have. How is Assad a threat to the U.S.?
He isn't.
They don't
want
any stable united government in the Middle East. They want them divided to continue to take their resources, their oil, etc.
He's not a threat to the American people. He's a threat to the American elite that
yeah,
want
right.
to profit off of Syria's land, the resources of Syria, And, the very top elite that, they have their plans with the Middle East, they wanted to eliminate Syria and Iran because they're the only two states in the Middle East that unilaterally completely are against the state of Israel, and number two are not on this IMF shadow government crap. Syria and Iran are leaning more towards the new way of banking, the one that's going to crush the old former shadow government empire and make this new empire starting that's going to be, it's going to free us from this old IMF banking crap.
Now, which one of you mentioned about that pipeline and explain about the significance of this pipeline?
I believe they have a, I said about the pipeline. I think there's Syria, there's one. I think it's a natural gas pipeline. It's going from, I think it goes through North Syria. I think it goes something like Israel to Russia or something like that. And, since that's
the
plan.
They even found oil on the coast of Gaza. I mean, there's always ulterior motives behind these actions.
Well, you have to realize that when you hear all this nonsense when they talk about American interests, you have to realize from the Gulf area, they're looking at where they can be able to pipe oil from anywhere from Saudi Arabia, any of those Gulf nations where they can pipe that right through that region to Iraq. Eventually, they want to pipe it right through Iran and also Afghanistan, where they can create pipelines going right to those potentially slave markets of the working class of China and also India. This has been in the works for well over 50 years, And that's the pipelines that we're talking about. Now, I guess, Al, you can, and also Chris, you're aware that Russia has also signed agreements to pipe in oil to China as well. Are you aware of that?
Well, yeah, they have new gas agreements between Russia and China. And now they're doing the trade no longer in the petrodollar. However,
hello.
Now
in their
own national currencies. Right now, this is a big change. Honestly, I think this is going to spell out major changes in how we use currency in the United States will be coming up in the next few years because the U.S. dollar, the one we knew, the whole Federal Reserve system of the U.S. dollar, they're going to have to reconfigure it because the U.S. dollar is about to collapse.
Exactly.
The reason the U.S. dollar used to exist is because since they took it off the gold standard, only thing that's been keeping it alive is that commodities are traded in the United States dollar. But when the commodities
exactly.
are no longer being traded in the United
exactly.
States dollar, it means crap.
It becomes
be like
worthless.
The German money in the 19-teens when they started using it for firewood, in substitute of firewood,
exactly.
they were burning German Deutschmarks. It's going to happen the same, may not to the same extreme, but there's going to be a lot of
I believe it's going to happen to the same extreme.
You think?
The
Crimea
has already accepted the rubles, and countries that are not part of the EU, like Switzerland, they still have francs. The Deutschmark doesn't exist anymore. They have the euro. Actually, the Germans, who used to have Deutschmark, they're the only stable country left in Europe. They haven't really been affected much by the crisis. There's still some poverty in Germany, but economically, they're the top right now. And then
one of the things I want to expand on when we look at the insecurity of this country right now, we are violating certain agreements that they had since World War II, where the Germans were not to become a military power at that time, and we can see that within the European countries, the Germans are becoming the power, military power elite within that region. We see also Japan. We see the U.S. has now lifted the restraint where Japan can become a military power, and also we are funneling money into Japan to build up their militaries. We see that we're also doing this in the Philippines as well. So subsequently, the U.S. now has gotten to the point where they do not have the finances to sustain their military empire, and now they're starting to rely on other governments that at one time were under international restraint from building their militaries. How do you see where this plays into the military globalization of what the U.S. agenda.
I think the United States, what they're doing right now by letting Japan become, super militarized again, where they kind of now have an offensive army, and with Germany, they're letting them become super militarized. Honestly, I think that the allies the United States has, the countries that they're still allied with, they're going to make sure they become super militarized because they're trying to make their own little team, the countries that are under the IMF, it's really not the United States, it's the shadow government empire. They're trying to do one last stand because they know that their empire is about to collapse in favor of BRICS. And honestly, I think they're getting ready for a global war. We're almost at the point of that happening, and it seems like this Ukraine thing, the United States has been trying to make excuses as if they're trying to start a war, a global war. They're definitely trying to start a war in Syria, and Syria could lead to Iran, and Iran could lead to Russia very easily. It looks like they are trying to spark war as they're trying to save their petrodollar.
It's right. A war of two factions of capitalism that is kind of irrelevant to the working class. The U.S. is the dominant military power in the world. It ceased to be the dominant economic power in the world. But, this is again, two sides are capitalistic. I mean, within Ukraine and the resistance of the fascists, you have some leftist forces, but they haven't really organized to be able to take power there yet. I mean, they have a region that's gained autonomy, not quite independence yet. Crimea rejoined Russia, but eastern Ukraine, it's very difficult there.
I just want to take a very quick break and just announce that we have Al Suarez. He's joining our program once again, and we're discussing, and we also have Chris on the line today, and I appreciate that. Has the empire reached beyond its limits? And later on during the program, we will discuss how should we remember 9/11 or September the 11th. Al, I want to thank you again for joining the program. And also, Chris, thanks for chiming in on this discussion today. Now, when we look at, what is being done globally, one of you mentioned that we're, already on the threshold of U.S. intervention in Europe, where potentially we could go to war with Russia, but now we're signing up countries around the country. We have just recently, we have Canada said that they will be there in regards to the U.S. intervention there in the Middle East. Now, I think what is happening with ISIS is only being used as a means of recruiting nations to become allies of this country. That's the only thing that they're being used for. We have Canada. We have just recently Australia say they're coming on board. So just as we saw during the Second World War, we have the same thing that is taking place today. We have the U.S. is leading an effort. I should say Obama, because he's operating outside of Congress, but we know Congress is right in the back pockets of this president. But we can see it's a global effort that is building toward war. One of you said not nuclear war, but I don't think nuclear war is off the table. These guys are complete idiots. We think in terms of the effects on the world over the next, decade or so. They think in terms of the next 200 or 300 years. As long as they can maintain global, they don't care if they have to go and live under the ground for the next and raise families and generations to come for the next, 50, 100, 200 years. But I personally don't think that a nuclear attack is off the table.
And when you talk about the enemy, you got to know the difference between the different groups, because a lot of people, they think that, Muslim Brotherhoods are, moderates by comparison, just like ISIS. Who's a lot closer to ISIS are those same moderates that are fighting beside them. I mean, a lot of people don't realize right now that the moderates have a united front with ISIS. They're not fighting each other. They're united against Assad. So the United States is going to pretend to distinguish between the two and attack ISIS at the same time. I think they're using that as a cover to attack Assad because they're going to, do some symbolic attacks against ISIS. And then they're going to, because they're already in Syria, they're going to go ahead and do what they want to do last year and start a bombing Assad.
Right. And let me ask you, when we look at what is taking place there in the Middle East, indirectly or directly, I mean, how does this fit into the agenda of trying to reach there into Moscow? Because we can see that the president has been making direct threats against, Vladimir Putin, he's not a friend of mine, you know. But, I mean, I don't think he's one that you want to start making direct threats against that person if you want to maintain any semblance of peace in the world. But how does that fit as far as what is taking place there in the Middle East, and where does Russia come into play? Because Russia's already said, if you start flying over Syria and bombing Syria, we're going to get involved.
Well, they're saying it's an attack on their sovereignty without permission of the elected Syrian government. But, you know, thanks to Russia's diplomatic intervention last year, they prevented the United States from intervening in Syria. The United States was resentful for that. And now they think Russia's weak over Ukraine, and they can go ahead with their plans, you know, and use ISIS as the excuse they needed to go ahead and intervene in Syria. And there is a Russian base in Syria. You can imagine if there's aerial attacks in Syria, if they accidentally, or quote-unquote accidentally, you know, kill Russian citizens on that base, what would
the
response be?
So there, yeah. I mean, where there's Russian troops and, I mean, not Syrian, but there's Russian troops and a base right there that's maintained by the Russian military?
Right. When Crimea was part of Ukraine, there was a Russian base as well. So the Russians don't have many military bases in the United States, but the Russians have some bases here or there that they've maintained since the time of the Soviet Union. So the Russia has their strategic interests in Syria as well. China also, they have the veto power, both those countries, to prevent a UN invasion like they did during Yugoslavia, but they can go to NATO and try to intervene. You can have other European countries, including Germany, go back into Ukraine and support these fascists that are in power there to overtake the rest of the Ukrainian country, the eastern part, up to the border of Russia.
I'm going to change shift gears a little bit because I want to get back to when we look at what has taken place as far as the banks and how they're financing, you know, both sides. But the banks, really what they're trying to do is protect their interests, because the banks are using, whether we want to face it or not, they're funding both sides. They're funding the Russians. they're funding the Germans. They're funding the U.S. They're funding Canada. If anyone doesn't know who the central bankers are, you know, they're funding both sides. But, you know, since 2008, certain things have gone very contrary to the capitalist model. They believe this thing where, you know, hope and change that, you know, people buy into this BS that the future is always going to get better. It's going to be pie in the sky. And, you know, what they do is they inflate the dollar. They have people, we used to call it Reaganomics, but, you know, they have the phony economics where people are buying into the stock market and thinking that the economy is doing well. And the working class go and work like slaves, but in the end result, the workers don't benefit from it. But we can see whether it's in war whether it's in a failing economy, we see that the super rich still benefit.
Well, yeah, they always benefit. They've rigged the game pretty much to where they can't lose. You know, they're really skilled con artists, really. That's what these top bankers are. You know, these people got billions of dollars, you know, families that have a collective of, you know, in one family they'll have trillions of dollars, you know, like the Rothschild family. You know, not one person, but the whole family's net worth is over $1 trillion, and how much influence they have in the central banks is just the unfathomable amounts of money. That, you know, I really wonder how these people can get this greedy, you know, where they keep wanting more and more. And they do it by, you know, they have all these central banks that they influence. They can manipulate who goes to war with each other, all these top bankers. They definitely, you know, and then there's also involved with the war. You know, United States, you know, right before we had almost attacked Syria a year ago, you had Raytheon stocks went, you know, off the charts. And, you know, every
right.
time a war starts, their stocks go up. So they benefit
right.
heavily from war, you know, all these defensive subcontractors that the government uses to get supplies for the war.
I believe it was 90% last year against a military intervention in Syria. This time you have like 70% in favor because it's not Assad this time, it's ISIS, and Americans don't like to see their fellow countrymen being beheaded. But I think that if Obama changes course and starts attacking Assad during that, and the American people find out about it, you know, they might claim it's an accident. But if the American people catch on to, you know, that there's other plans in order, the public opinion can change on that as well, especially if you see a situation where, you know, the United States is having ground troops there.
You know, Assad also, you know, they talk about moderate rebels and stuff like that. There is no, distinction between the moderate rebels, a.k.a. the Free Syrian Army, and then there's the Islamic Front, then there's the ISIS. Yeah, well, all these are on the same side. You know, they're all in one coalition.
At least they're American. They're not as bad as ISIS, apparently. But ISIS, they'll go right ahead and behead them.
Well, FSA, you know, Free Syrian Army, I've seen them do the despicable stuff on YouTube. You know, there was that one infamous video. I don't know if you guys have seen it, where the guy eats the FSA commander eats the guy's liver on video. I had the unfortunate of having to see that.
It was terrible.
Well,
yeah.
Let me ask you: when we see all this on
minister.
Television. When we
he said,
see all this,
that you're supporting, they're eating human organs, and you should have seen his face.
Right.
Yeah, he acted like it was normal, that guy that was eating the guy's liver.
I mean, but when we see this, I mean, this is really propaganda for the American public. Because, I mean, you know, I mean, the stuff where I see where they have the guy in orange and they have the little mound of sand and you got the boogeyman standing there with a knife at the guy's throat. I mean, I think within a night's time you must have seen that at least a couple dozen times. I mean, don't even turn to Fox News. They have it on like all for 24/7. But we have to realize since July of 2013, this Congress, the Congress of the U.S., repealed the ban on propaganda. So Americans, I mean, whether you're on the Internet, whether you're looking at television, forget about any of those rag newspapers. We're receiving propaganda 24/7 to lull people into potentially going into these conflicts and supporting these nonsense conflicts. Because what we see, as I mentioned about the journalists being killed, this is being put up as a means to promote propaganda with the American people. This should not even be seen on television.
It's certainly propaganda, you know. And you go on Fox News, I mean, they're doing like a total like sports breakdown on this stuff. I mean, they're like,
yeah,
okay,
exactly.
You think this was an 8-inch knife or a 9-inch knife? I mean, they're getting down. They just find any excuse to keep playing that because they know how horrific it you know, goes into the hearts of Americans. However, you know, ISIS is a bad group. It was made by the United States government to fight Assad, and now they're going to pretend to strike them when they're really going to take out Bashar al-Assad, which is the only, in my opinion, legitimate government in Syria. You know, before Assad, before Assad had to face these terrorists and mercenaries from the West, you know, Syria was booming. It was a booming socialist nation, actually. You know, Bashar al-Assad is a part of the Baas, I don't know how you pronounce the first word in that name, but the Socialist Party there in Syria, you know, it was actually a decent country, and then, you know, the terrorist attack started from these Western-supported groups. They call them moderate rebels when they're, in all reality, they're just varying degrees of terrorists.
I've seen pictures of McCain posing with al-Baghdadi. That's the guy
okay.
who started ISIS. Well, because they were
okay.
on the other side of the border in Syria, then it was okay, right?
I mean, right.
Oh, yeah.
Is
it true that – I don't know how true this is, but one of the people that is shown in that photo with McCain when he went to Syria met with those people in the opposition that the caliph, you know, the self-proclaimed caliph of the Islamic State, McCain met as one of the opposition people in Syria.
Well, he met the founder of ISIS, that's for sure. He met him a couple
you don't know how true
back
it
back
is. It is. It
and
is true. Like
that, he's dead now, but
so that is the guy. I just didn't want to say that I wasn't going to put that as fact. When I wasn't sure if that was fact. I just saw on
Facebook.
They're
not sure if Baghdadi is his real name. They're saying he's Iraqi. Who knows? But the guy
I've heard stuff that
ISIS,
he's actually. Is that the
you
guy
know,
started ISIS
his,
was Israeli.
His beard was not as prominent in the picture, but same face, same guy. And it would have surprised me because, you know, McCain, you know, he did the same thing in Libya, you know. He was in Libya during a lynching, you know. Then they were lynching black Libyans in Benghazi. You know, he'll support anybody, you know, racist, terrorist, you know, whoever. You know, he'll go there as, you know, the ambassador to the U.S., you know, supporting these proxy wars.
I'm just going to take another short break here, and then we're going to continue in our second segment of this program today. We have Al Suarez joining us, and we also have Chris. Chris, what is your last name?
Well, actually, my last name I use on radio is Jay. However,
okay,
yeah.
I'll say Chris Jay. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, for radio.
Okay, we have Chris Jay. He's joining our program today. And our topics today are including, has the empire reached beyond its limits, and how should we remember 9/11? And we're going to spend probably around 15 minutes or so talking about 9/11 because, let's face it, I don't know how, you know, Al, I think you were probably a young teenager. Chris, you were probably a teenager at the time when it happened.
I was 3 years old when it happened.
You were 3 years old.
I'm 16
old, okay.
Now.
But I remember very distinctly when Kennedy, when he was killed, I was on a playground in 1963 there at George Washington Carver Elementary School, and it was like the world has stopped. Everyone said, you know, the president's been killed. And all the kids, within 1 minute, everyone was standing. There was no balls being bounced. Baseballs had stopped being thrown, you know, and within a matter of minutes, they told all the students, all the kids, that you got to come in school, come into the classroom. And then we sat there for the next couple of hours while we were watching sobbing teachers and principals and vice principals. Everyone was crying that the president was dead. So when I look at 9/11, I like to say September the 11th because this is something that has been, you know, when you dial 9/11 on your phone, everything is like tied in around 9/11, so we will never forget. The only thing I don't want to forget is about the 2,900 people that were innocent victims of this. But the other part, I suspect the rest of it because so much has come out over the Internet. People sharing information that scientists have presented to the American people that there was something very amiss with 9/11. Al, I'm going to let you start out by, what are your opinions about 9/11? Was it a terrorist attack? Or some people are saying that planes didn't even hit the building. What are we talking about here?
Well, first I want to mention what you were saying about Kennedy when he was assassinated, very reminiscent of when I was in high school and we heard about the towers falling. You know, they, of course, canceled the classes for the rest of the day, and there was students, you know, in tears before the TV. And you know, I was living in Vermont at the time, and some of the students reacted in different ways.
You know exactly where you were at that moment when it happened, correct?
I think it was in my biology class, but and we got the announcement. I think the first announcement was that it was misinformation. They said that there was a car bomb at the Pentagon or something, and then they found out that it was the Twin Towers, and the Pentagon was something else. But you know, when you first get news out, you know, sometimes you get the wrong information. It's not always intentional. But one of the students remarked, you know, well, Bush must have accidentally pressed a button and made the towers explode, you know, because Bush wasn't very liked at the time. But, you know, I'm surprised he got reelected. I believe it was by a small margin. I mean, maybe they rigged the elections again. Who knows? But,
well,
you know,
I mean, he came and said, you know, oh, I found the weapons of mass destruction and the terrorists that are, you know, trying to destroy our government. Oh, he got reelected based on a lie. You know, if right. if we had all the evidence that we had and we really had a commission that was really trying to find out the truth, do you think Bush would have gotten elected a second time? You know, they probably would have had him in some type of court.
I think one of the most powerful, compelling arguments for the case for the conspiracy behind 9/11 is not so much, you know, was it a missile that hit the Pentagon or how the towers fell. I think it all comes down to Building 7, because if you see the live BBC report,
explain about Building 7, because some of our listeners don't understand when you say Building 7.
Yeah, I'm going to explain right now. I'm just saying that in the past when the BBC's messed up like this, they erased the footage. The footage is still out there. You can find it on YouTube, so don't just take my word for it. But Building 7 was a completely intact building that was near the Twin Towers, but after the collapse of the towers, several hours after the collapse of the towers, like many buildings around, it was still intact. And the BBC did a live report in front of the building, okay? So while the report's going on, you see there's no debris, there's no damage, there's no broken glass. You can very clearly see the building is still intact behind the reporter while they're reporting and saying that Building 7 has collapsed. 20 minutes later, 20 minutes after they reported that building collapsed and they got the wrong information, then that building suddenly was demolished. It looked exactly what a demolition would look like. And that building was probably the control tower for the demolition. So it was a combination of the planes and the way the towers fell. I mean, countless scientists have said it. You could look at other cases of towers that were on fire in Spain and Asia and all these other countries where towers have been on fire for several hours and never collapsed. So for the buildings to collapse the way they did, they had to have been wired. And, you know, there's also people that have said that workers went in, you know, a couple days before and they closed the building down, and that's when they could have wired it. And the guy who owned the Twin Towers, you know, he put out a life insurance on it, you know, a couple weeks before, and he wasn't there. None of his family members were there when it collapsed. So I
right.
think there was some people that knew about it, some intelligence agencies that from this nation and other nations that knew about it, and they wanted it to happen. Because it benefited what they wanted to do, to go to war, you know, to increase the drug trade in Afghanistan, protect the oil pipelines over there, and then to go into Iraq and take the oil from there as well, and to protect Israel. And so there was a lot of other things involved in, you know, the narrative that we're told, you know. And I think people are more cynical now because of politicians since 9/11,
right.
kind of like they were in the late 60s when it came to politics, as they were. We're realizing the conspiracy with Kennedy, they became more cynical as a result.
Well, you know, very interesting.
Our list is one where you want to be empowered and be like, okay, this is bad politics, but let's do something about it. That's more of my point.
Very interesting you say cynical, because when people become cynical and when they don't trust the government, what do they do? They create a police state. So since you don't believe us, we're gonna have police out there keeping you in line, and we can see that the Pentagon has spent over $500 billion making certain that police departments around the country have been armed to the teeth. When I look at 9/11, September the 11th, 2001, Al, I guess you're aware that the country was in a financial, economic straitjacket at the time. We saw what happened in 2008, but a lot of people don't realize at the end of 2000, at the end of the economic miraculous economic recovery that Clinton had, that the country was in almost on the verge of economic collapse in 2000 and also 2001, and then we had what happened on September the 11th. We had a similar event we had in 2008, and the president, he came in, President Obama said, I'm going to turn this around, I'm going to bring our troops home, and all of a sudden they started creating all sorts of causes why we still needed to be involved. But Al, were you aware that we were on the verge of an economic collapse in 2000?
No. I mean, they say that there was a surplus, and towards the end of Clinton's government, and
that, you know, the Bush kind of messed it up from the very beginning. But no, in the late 90s, we were that surplus that initially Clinton had was starting to decline. And, you know, Bush expanded on that decline. And, yeah, there could have been economic reasons as well behind, I mean, nationwide that you can see that there was economic problems into 2001. And, yeah, you know, the Twin Towers was a major financial center, and that being lost, right, how would that help the economy?
What about this revelation that Rumsfeld was that he was poised to give a statement that the military of this country, that there was $2.5 trillion of debt for the U.S. military just before the towers collapsed, and all of a sudden, once we were on our pathway to war, it wasn't no need to talk about this debt that the military had. In other words, we need to forget about the debt because now we need to go to war. But what do you know about this debt that Rumsfeld was going to? Pardon me?
War's used as a distraction as well.
Right. War very often is used as a distraction because, you know, people, when it comes to global conflicts, well, I shouldn't say global conflicts, more money will be put into a war effort than any other purpose that man can create. In other words, whether it's to revitalize the economy, whether it's to take care of the infrastructure, to take care of the needs of the people, the poor, the working class, whatever, all those take a second seat to war. And as I was mentioning, is that the country was in dire straits. 2008, right. They were in dire straits. And we can see that we're on the pathway, we're on the same pathway that will get us there within the next year. I'm expecting, unless something changed, and I'm not, you know, I'm not the eternal optimist that I was when I was a kid, but something needs to change. But 9/11, did they ever find, Chris, are you still there?
Yeah.
Did they ever find these planes that supposedly went into the Pentagon?
No, they never found any. They found no luggage. They found no wreckage. They found nothing. You know, one of the people that walked right out of the hole that the plane supposedly created said she found nothing. There was no plane. There was no sign that plane had hit. They showed that same one camera.
But it was a missile, probably. Another thing, the Taliban.
Now,
how is this?
Yeah. I know you're not scientists. Both of you are not scientists, but you know you don't really have to have any brains to sort of figure this out. You know, I don't have a lot of brains myself, but you know, if a plane flies into a building, you're going to at least find the landing gear. Am I right? Or am I wrong?
There's going to be some stuff. I mean, there's in former wrecks before that, there was always wreckage. I mean, you see in the 9/11, the planes just seem to disappear, you know, and then, but you know what they do find out? Anything they find passports laying on the ground at the Twin Towers. You know, the passports of the hijackers. Come on,
chances
of that happening.
Some of the debris has to be recovered. There was a cover up, and it was probably a missile. It was directed in a renovated area, so there wasn't a lot of workers in the Pentagon. And again, one of the first things that the Taliban did when September 11th happened was offered up Bin Laden in exchange for evidence he was behind 9/11. The United States never had this evidence. The United States never wanted to bring Bin Laden or any of the scapegoats to trial. So there's evidence also that Bin Laden was a double agent. I mean, he was at least an asset of the CIA at some level, even up till 2001.
Chris, you brought up a very important point. They talk about, you say they found passports or whatever. We saw that 11 of these supposedly hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. Help me to connect the dots. You know, the hijackers, the supposedly terrorists, come from Saudi Arabia. How is it that we went to declare war on Iraq? How is that?
Well, the thing is, it was never about really finding these supposed terrorists. You know, it was about making sure Iraq didn't trade in the petrodollar in all reality. And
okay, good point.
And you know, also, about the Saudis. You know, didn't a few of those people that supposedly died, you know, burning up in the plane when they, you know, when they crashed into Twin Towers and all these hijackers. Weren't a couple of those people, didn't they say later that they were alive and over
in
Saudi Arabia?
Were university students in Saudi Arabia alive? So they used fake identities for some of those terrorists. They weren't the actual terrorists that were in the plane. And I just wanted to say that, you know, I myself recently went, you know, because I've been disgusted with ISIS and groups like it for a long time and what they're doing in Syria. I myself was almost supportive of the airstrikes. But then I realized that, you know, if they have these airstrikes right now in Syria, where did ISIS live? These aren't going to be strikes that are in some, you know, distant desert. They're in towns. They're in Raqqa and Aleppo and these towns in northern Syria.
They target civilians.
Exactly. So that's not the way to go about it. And supporting moderates, I don't believe in that either, because, like I said, the moderates sold one of the American ISIS. They're pretty much one and the same. So there has to be another way to deal with this, you know, diplomatically, you know, or something. Because, I mean, I agree with supporting the Kurds, though, 100%. I'm not sure if they can have Kurdistan yet, but, you know, there are some Kurd and leftist Kurdish groups that are legitimate and should be supported in northern Iraq. And those Kurds are very trustworthy when it comes to fighting ISIS because, you know, they're not, you know, Sunni. They're a different tribe, and they've been persecuted for a long time by people like ISIS, and it's good that they're fighting them, and they should be supported. Bombing is not the way.
Well, you know, there is an alternative, but the United States government won't do that because that's not their true agenda. Their true agenda is to take out Assad and then I think eventually take out Rouhani in Iran and the Iranian, the whole
thing. Exactly.
And reversing the Khamenei revolution in Iran. You know, so they're not going to work with Iran and Syria on defeating ISIS. You know,
the Ayatollahs aren't saints either, but definitely if you compare them to ISIS, I mean, the ISIS are just pure barbaric acts, what they've been doing.
Well, Khamenei, I would say if we're going to go historical, I think they're a long shot there than what the United States brought in by the 1953 Iranian coup that now we have evidence that the CIA actually was involved in.
Leader. And they brought in
You know, I think, Chris, you brought up this point, which I think is a very good point. We saw, I say, why did we go after Iraq instead of going after Saudi Arabia? But you have to realize that countries that wanted to move away from the petrodollar, we had Iran, Syria, and we also had Libya. And most importantly, what we have seen in recent history is Iraq. Because of the petrodollar. Those countries wanted to move away from the use of the American petrodollar. The other thing is oil. Those countries, if you consider the resources or oil resources in that area, just those countries right there, is well over 300 billion barrels of oil. 300 billion barrels of oil. So you're looking at the vast resources that we're looking at controlling in that area. Let me just, beyond just, because we have just around three more minutes here, beyond just whether it's a conspiracy or whatever, I'm talking to Chris and also Al, do we believe that it's only a conspiracy or do we believe that it's more substance, that the story is not the way it's being told with 9/11, and again, it fits into that propaganda of this country.
Yes, it's definitely a very complex thing. 9/11 is a little piece of a puzzle. You know, 9/11 goes right there with the JFK. It's the shadow government. There's a higher up. You know, you see your president. He's just a spokesman. He's the one that they want you to think is the leader, but there's other people above him. There's Kissinger. There's these power families above him, this shadow, this IMF banking thing, you know?
The president, as you mentioned, he's a spokesman, not for this country, but he's a spokesman for the IMF. Al, what is your thinking on that? We have around another minute. I just want you to give you contact information. What is your thinking on that? Is it just conspiracy, or is there really some truth to what we see that something was amiss with 9/11?
The best way to keep a secret is fear.
So people that have spoken out have been persecuted or disappeared. This happened, you know, the days after Kennedy as well. So for those that say, well, you can't keep a secret and, you know, it's impossible there was a conspiracy, you know, yeah, maybe a secret that's some rumor where you can say the rumor, nothing will happen to you. But if you're somebody with evidence and you want to come forward, you know, the mass media is going to ignore you and you're going to be possibly taken out. So that's why a lot of the people that were involved that had that evidence, they've been silent. So I think it is realistic that there was a conspiracy. I'm sure many levels of the government did not know about it. There was only certain sectors, you know, kind of fascist sectors of the government that were behind it or that let it happen. So, yeah, I do think it was a conspiracy. And just to end, people can find me on Ruthann's page or Stewart's page on Facebook, Al Suarez, S-U-A-R-E-Z, and I co-host a show from time to time on Sunday evenings on Blog Talk Radio with Chris J. as well.
And again, I'd like to thank Al for joining our program today. Also, I want to thank Chris J. for joining us. Made this a very interesting discussion today. And we will look forward to having all of our listeners to join us once again next week on the Socialist Insight Left Turn with Stuart Alexander. Thanks again.
That's right.
See you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Ruth Dan.
You're listening to Aramar Tefeo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
The Dialogue. I'm Ruth Ann, and I'm joined by Karen Patrick and Ken Withrow. Hello, guys.
Hello.
So, we settled on talking about urban sustainability concepts, right?
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So, who wants to start diving in?
I would love it.
Go. You shoot first. I'm. I always like going behind you because you tend to like have all these crazy things I don't think about always thrown at me.
Oh yeah, I've got one too. I've got zombie houses. The attack of the zombie houses was an article I picked up as we're getting ready for the show, and this was an article. I don't have the information in front of me, but it was a story about a woman who had, she got behind on her payments for her house, and this is in Florida. And she was told, you know, that the bank sent her a notice that she was going to be foreclosed on. She said, okay, well, you know, I can't do anything about it. I can't save my house. So she packed up her kids and went and moved into an apartment. And she was on SSI for health problems. And suddenly they cut her off, and they said, well, it's because, you know, you have a home. You've got a resource. You own a home. And this is like 4 years later, right? So she goes and she finds out that the bank threatened to foreclose, but they never followed through. So she has a 4-year-old house. It's gutted. It's had, you know, notices on it for code enforcement because it's all, you know, ratty and has weeds and, you know, pipes are all pulled out of it. And she's got back taxes on it. I mean, it's a nightmare. Fortunately, she was able to find some legal aid and get some help and get all that straightened out. But this is this, urban renewal issue, and I'm in a neighborhood that is just, you know, it's kind of on its last legs. It was really a happening place back in the 40s, and now, you know, we have a lot of empty lots. We have a lot of burnt-out houses because people will, you know, suddenly there will be a fire there, and they can collect insurance, and we have a lot of foreclosed homes. And a lot of homes that, you know, they look like they're in pretty good shape. They're just boarded up. And one house I know of that someone did live in and just a few years ago, and now it's just boarded up because they couldn't get a renter and the windows got broken out. And there's just a lot of that around here in this particular area.
We'll put the zombie house article on the page.
after the show.
Because I think it really tells the story. And then the other article that we might want to put on, too, as I sent it to you guys, was about how people are not allowed to be off the grid in Florida. Again, Florida. What's up with Florida? And also a similar situation here in Texas where people are trying to live off the grid and be sustainable, and they're offending somebody, you know, so they're getting literally like SWAT teams coming after them, you know, for some. In one case, the guy didn't pay a parking ticket or something, and they came after him on his property because they're just doing something out of the norm and trying to live off the grid.
Actually, the only thing they could get him for was the parking ticket, but they had come because somebody, you know, quote-unquote somebody, had reported drug selling, which... different municipalities and cities and companies, they don't want you off the grid because they want to get money off of you. And so we're going to find more and more of these attacks.
The funny thing with that, though, which came from flipping all the houses and, like, you know, what I had done, because I had this happen to me. It's real funny. I lived in a place where I couldn't have a pickup in my driveway because – the other homeowners felt it inflicted on their property. And so I started researching. This is all stuff that was written into the code of the neighborhood. Each neighborhood has its own bylaws. That if you go into a subdivision especially, and it's all filed. There is no secret. And that's the one thing, like I say when I see these articles, as you read through them, is... it's not that they're, like, all of a sudden going after them so much as all of a sudden people are trying, and they're finding out that they lived in a neighborhood that had these rules. So then it's just learning the rules and fixing them. Going in and going, this is a stupid rule. And then going to the town meetings and applying for rezoning and, applying for, you know, abolishment of certain rules or whatever. Or even better, applying for variances in the rules for certain aspects, you know, make yourself public and known. It helps, but obviously that's a whole other topic and subject in itself.
That's a good point. When you are going someplace to buy, this place that where they invaded their homes on this bogus stuff, I mean, they had been there for years. So this was because... all of a sudden, they were teaching other people. They started holding workshops and things, and they became public.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was why they were attacked. But when you're going to buy someplace, you really need to find out all of this stuff ahead because it's true. Some subdivisions, some suburbs are really hell.
It's Illinois, Ruthann, you'll like this. It was Homewood. Flossmoor, I could not have a pickup truck.
Yes.
In the driveway in Flossmoor. Yep. And I wasn't the only one this happened to. I also was asked to remove my work van once. Indiana. Yeah, my work van was an eyesore. Now, this is a neighborhood of cops and construction workers. But they were trying to upgrade the property value.
Exactly.
And they felt that they... yeah, and it's what it's about. It's all... it's
Oak Park is that way, too. Yeah, yeah.
Oak Park is...
really, really bizarre. Yeah. And people don't necessarily know. I mean, they find a house, they fall in love, and the price is right. And they get there and they find out, well, you know, a lot of places you can't have clotheslines. And
that's more common than you would think, too. It's really funny.
I know. It just... that's what, you know, as much as I complain sometimes about living in bumfuck, because I don't live in Chicago. I live out.
Yeah.
You know, I am. Clotheslines are fine. You can have a little fire in your backyard. Actually, sometimes my neighbors have a big fire. Still, you know, it's still whatever. You have a few rights. My neighbor a couple years ago got a... he picked up, I mean, this is sort of on topic, but I mean, as far as that goes, he found some old used toilet somebody had junked, and he put it in our front yard,
And, you know, I said, well, you're going to put that in the – I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm going to make a planter. And I said, well, you're going to put it in the backyard, right? He said, no, I'm going to keep it up here. Well, the thing is, he didn't put anything in it. I had a party.
Oh,
some
man.
Some of my people used it. Well, you know, I mean, it was like, my God.
That's genius.
So anyway, all of a sudden, after about, I don't know, a month or more, it disappeared. Now, he did nothing with it. So I'm not sure if the city took pity on us or if somebody else came along and stole it because they wanted to make a plant.
Pity on the toilet. Yeah.
I'm just telling you, in my neighborhood,
is that
it's
a
not
pity pot?
A pity pot. It's not a bad, I mean, I didn't call them because, but I did tell somebody, you know, if you want to take this and dump it or make a planter, please do. So maybe someone did.
Yeah.
And my neighborhood is not a bad neighborhood. But, I mean, I'm just saying that we still have some kinds of freedom where I live. Obviously,
oh,
since there was a toilet out in front for over a month. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't think I would do very well in one of those burbs or someplace where
you had to get out.
Well, yeah, you can only have, like, two bushes in your front yard, and they have to be
mm-hmm.
on either side of your doorway. You know, I mean, when they get down to this kind of stuff, it's like...
It's a very sterile, cloned
neighborhood. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's not even... How can you even have...
Well, that's your McMansions now. You're in an area where it's a dictated design community, and it's, you know, like, I lived in one off and on through the past 20 years until I got this place. This place... Like, the old owner would mow naked and stoned, and he was a psychology professor in Chicago. I'm not kidding. He had a riding mower. He would wear boots and a hat with a raccoon skull on it, and he would get stoned, and he would mow and just drive around and mow. And the neighbors knew, you know, we barely see each other, you know. I mean, they're across the street, but, like, you know, it was kind of up on a hill in a way. And, you know, like my kids, you'll find my kids naked on the trampoline all the time. You know, I mean, the oldest kid you see doing this is probably 20, I'm not kidding, he's like 6 or 7. And, you know, and I mean, but the neighbors don't know, you know, they don't see anything. And, like, I built a chicken coop, nobody even knew I did it. You know, like, I built tree houses all the time, you know. I mean, I came here for that reason. And I made sure I was as close to off the grid as I could be already, you know. And so then all I had to do was just get panels. I mean, people out here have propane already. My house is one of the few that has gas, community gas, you know. But I'm on a well and septic already, you know. But, like, when you're in those communities,
really are we
crazy.
All, except I'm kind of in an old suburb division, and you guys sound a little bit more rural. How does that figure
mm-hmm.
into the urban thing? Suburban,
well, there's no
like
getting off the grid all the way in the urban setting because you have one of the big things that will get you arrested is health codes. And you have to abide by them. You live in a community. The health codes were established long before, you know, they were put there at the same time the community was put there. So the health codes all tie to water and waste. And as long as you follow the water and waste, if you don't, you know, like, here's what I tell people that are trying to get off grid in an urban setting. Stay tied to the grid, but produce your own power. It's legal.
Yeah.
It's not going to hurt you, and it's cheaper. And why not? Because in the end, even Tesla said this, like, you don't want to be separate from everyone. It's nice to be able to do that, so then put batteries in later. You get a second inverter. It's another, $1,000-$2,000, a decent second inverter, one that it'll take the power produced, and it'll switch. So then one will go and send it to your power company, or
mm-hmm.
the other, you know, your surplus, and there you build up, that's your battery bank at that point, your power broker. Or you put it in your battery bank when that goes out. Having a backup generator in an urban setting, very legal, if it's in a noiseless environment.
It is.
So
there's
nothing wrong with you having solar panels. People don't realize that. What it is so follow their rules. Yeah, they want to make money. What they really want is to sell your power. They make more money selling your power than they do selling you power. So it's less on them. So what you want to do, they all power companies promote putting tied to the grid solar panels up. Same with wind, same exact thing. Now, going to water, you don't want to be tied to city water, fine. Stay tied to it and don't use it.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say, yeah.
Just don't
yeah.
use it. Just don't use the shit. I mean, people are fighting, like, the craziest battles here. Like, if it's already hooked, just leave it. Most, if you're in an urban setting, you are rarely on septic anyways. These days, yeah. it's so rare to be on septic. So you're already in city sewer. If you're on city sewer, you're more than likely on city water. Because they tend to build together. So
yeah.
if you're that, then just, you're that. You know, you want to be off-grid, then poop in a bucket with some cedar chips and, you know, whatever. Try and, you know, compost it and don't talk to people about it. But do it
yeah.
to health code yeah. standard if that's the case. If it's water,
yeah.
just don't use the damn water. Power's
here,
a weird
here,
one.
Yeah,
oh,
here's a weird one that came up in Washington State, though. Is they now have some kind of a surcharge on people who are selling their power back because they said, well, you're using our wires, you know, to sell the power back. So they're starting to do a surcharge kind of smart-ass shit.
Sure, do it. Have your battery back up, and what
yeah.
you do is produce more power than you can use. The surcharge
okay.
comes off the surplus. It doesn't affect anyone. See, we still
yeah.
think in money. Think
mm-hmm.
in systems, you know, and then all of a sudden,
right.
so who gives a shit about a surcharge if I'm not paying for electric?
Right, exactly.
Take it off
okay.
my credit, you know? Like, that's the thing is put an extra panel up. It'll cost you a few hundred bucks, and then you got this extra panel. You're more than often giving them, like, right now, most houses, they get a credit at the end of the year with REMC, who I'm with, which is it's a community-owned power broker. They don't even produce
mm-hmm.
power. They buy it from different producers. And put together by all the farmers in the region, and because a lot of them were off-grid. And
mm-hmm.
so this is now more of a standard. You're seeing it everywhere. Like, more and more people are brokering power, and it ends up, for the community, really good. And they kind of, in a way, own it because it's all stockholder-owned. So with that one, like, they don't give you any money. They just give you a credit at the end of the year, you know? And if you're constantly producing power, the credit's worthless. But it's
yeah.
not worthless if they want to charge you, because then you just go, don't give me the credit. You know, take it off of that. And then what we were going to do here, when I was going to have tons of power produced from all the farms, when I was going to put it on this property, we were going to give it to the neighbors at Christmas. Just
oh,
have
yeah.
each, like, it divvied up amongst all the walking distance neighbors that I had. Just thank you for letting us be weird around you, you know? And which I owe them for years prior to the farm of all the parties and things I've thrown. Most of them attended, though, but still, you know, when you have 500 people for 2 days in your backyard, your neighbors do take notice, especially when the tents start leaking into their backyard. But,
yeah,
they notice. But, It is something, and that's how all the systems work. So the surcharge wouldn't affect you. Same with gas, you know. I mean, it's just a matter of finding the codes and slipping beneath them. You know, you just got to fit within the mold, and if it means you have to be attached to the grid, great. I'm worried that when the grid goes down, my power goes, okay, so have the battery backup.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Have that sitting there.
That's why you want the backups.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the generator or whether you just, you know, fix up some kind of a water system, whatever, you still need backups. But in the meantime,
that's the key to being off grid. You know, that's
your
key. Battle. Have your backup. Yeah.
Battle.
But a lot of the off grid stuff too, it's more like the rules that fall into, like, growing your own food. Like, you know what? Yeah, so most urban settings, you're not going to keep chickens. Funny thing, though, is that's not necessary for survival. You know, it's just, it's kind of, it's
no,
interesting.
No, meat is necessary for survival. Absolutely not.
Yeah. livestock is absolutely unnecessary. It's useful, but it's not necessary. And it's really weird when you're in an urban backyard because you really don't have the room to utilize a permaculture concept, you know, to utilize the tilling that they do and the things that it, having a chicken for is kind of useless in, you know, something that's like, you know, a sixth of an acre. It really doesn't help you. There's no rotation.
A lot of cities are letting you keep up to four chickens, not roosters. If I live on, I have the top of a two flat. If I had a, which I love, but if I lived on the ground level, I would probably have chickens, not because I would eat eggs, because I don't, and I sure don't kill chickens, but because chickens are so funny. I mean, they have such great personalities, and they're just, they're another kind of, I hate the word pet, but that kind of, you know, I mean, they're fun. I would have some if I lived down on the first floor, because I would want to interact with them more than I would if, you know, being on the second floor. But,
same with the goat, too. Some people do the same thing with goats. They don't drink the milk. They keep on the, you know, they're great for eating your compost. So are chickens. They're good at taking care of food waste. And it is a great way to live off the grid and not make stinky mess, because you would have these, a couple chickens. They would eat your garbage for you. That's what, I mean, all my food waste went straight to the chickens. We just kept the meat and bones out.
Well, my dream
is
village. Yeah,
a practical chicken question. Did they keep the flea level down? Because I know you said you would get, you know, monster fleas from hell. We do here in this area. Did that kind of keep that flea population down a little bit, the chickens?
I'll tell you, I absolutely doubt it, because we had a dog with one of the roommates, and the dog brought fleas in my house. And my cats got fleas. I don't treat my cats for fleas, you know, because they don't go outside. And I keep a few, you know, I keep them for mousing. And I had 15 chickens, but I also had 10 acres. So, like, really, honestly, I don't know if I had the parameters to validate that.
Oh,
but I'll tell you one thing. Hawks are really good at keeping your chicken population down. I learned that much. They really ate my chickens and loved them. Very thankful. The hawks were very, very thankful for the meals that I gave their chicks. And I ultimately sacrificed them all to the great hawk population on my property.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't do chickens this year because I want to free range them, so I have to come up with a better system. And I'm realizing I might incorporate a dog. And so I'm going back to, I got to consider the flea thing. And I had to treat for fleas, and I had chickens. But I had 10 acres. They wandered the whole property. I don't know. I mean, I highly doubt that's the case. I don't, because they don't really, I don't see how a chicken's going to get a flea. It was my point.
I didn't know that this is,
they're fairly stupid.
Farmer problems, you know.
Oh, they are stupid. And why wouldn't they get a flea?
Because they're so tiny, they don't see very well. You could put like stuff right in front of them, and they don't notice it.
Chickens wouldn't get fleas. You mean chickens wouldn't kill fleas? But birds get parasites. I know that.
On
themselves.
Now you got to learn animal husbandry issues. So on the urban thing, I think you're right. It gets complex in such a small place. You probably, whatever you get would have to be small, like the smaller chickens.
Yeah, that's
kind
of my
goats.
Thinking. The big one is, if you want your flea population down, if that is an issue, you get something for the fleas to hang out on during flea season. The better way to do fleas, it really isn't, is you create a pond and get some frogs, put a bat box up and have some bats, you know. But like chickens, I've had, like, in my basement during that infestation. It really wasn't one in the house, but you go in my basement and you literally have like 30 fleas on your feet when you walk down there. It was horrible.
We had that going on. We found out a way to do it. I know this is crazy. Like, we're talking about urban stuff, but we're really talking about rural stuff right now. But here's the deal. We put down mopped with Dawn dishwashing liquid, and that killed the fleas, and then we and also killed the eggs, and then we vacuumed to the vacuum cleaner, and we did that a couple times.
Yeah, vacuum
a week.
Karen, what was
you know, Don Dishlakely.
It was like a nuclear option for...
Well, it's heavily caustic. You know, we that was one of the options in the vertical farm for our aphids. And actually, when you get mayflies, this is a new one I learned, and it works really well because I make kombucha, so it's very vinegary, and, like, the mayflies love my kombucha jar because you top it. It has to aerate. So I top it with a thick layer of cheesecloth. So it vents the gases, but nothing can get in. Well, the mayflies basically just hang out there. And so...
Yeah.
What I found out was you put vinegar in another open jar and throw Dawn in it. And basically the vinegar and the soap they're like oil and water, you know, they don't mix. So they stay separate entities. Funny thing, vinegar is an acid, soap's a caustic. They don't cancel each other out. You still keep your vinegar smell. But the soap will sit there and it will basically kill the mayflies. And what was funny was I forgot I left the jar out. This is like the most horrible thing to witness. I was going to work on the kombucha jar, and I had another jar next to it with a starter for some bread. Anyways, they were there, and the fly killer jar was on top, and I bumped it. And it fell and then broke. So all over the counter was soapy vinegar with about 150 dead flies in it, little mayflies. And it was everywhere. And I'm so grossed out and realizing how well it worked and just like, okay, I get it. So, you know, I mean, there's, by the way, yeah, Don, it's incredible. It's like a Nazi tool for bugs. Like, you know,
yeah,
I mean, you're going to whack them
bit,
all.
Yeah, I had a wine bottle with a little bit of wine in the bottom of it, and I put a little Dawn in there, and I got rid of some ants in the corner of a kitchen one time because they all went in, and it's like Hotel California. You can check in anytime you want, but you can never leave.
That's it, though. They do that mosquito catchers, too.
This is the thing. Yeah, we're in a suburb, but we're learning all these farmy things.
Work so well in the suburbs.
Yeah,
but like your mosquito catcher, you do the same thing, but you use like a plastic bottle, and you cut the top off, and then you flip it and you tape it. So they have to go through the funnel. So you make it real difficult for them to get out. And you put in the bottom, basically, I can't remember what it is they like to smell. It's not vinegar. I can't remember what it was.
Citronella.
you put something down there.
You know what?
You put Karen Patrick in the bottom of the bottle. You have to have a lot of them. And then you cover her in Dawn. But the Dawn, though, kills them. And you know what it is?
Yeah,
it's because it eats their legs. Did you know that? That's how it works.
So
it eats their legs, and then they fall into it, and it eats up their bellies, and then they just basically rot into it.
Well,
we found that out when...
This is better than spraying Raid or something like that that I'm allergic to.
Oh, totally
so,
better. Yeah. Well, and you can just... You can flush it. You know, it's soap.
Yeah.
And as much as they say it's food grade, it's food grade enough to break down in water. It's very water soluble. The caustic goes away. The chemicals that are in it, I don't know, but it's just very, it's caustic in a horrible way. And the degreaser is another solvent. So it's just nasty. But we,
call for desperate measures at some point. Well, this is the thing, is learning all these things. Oh, my gosh, going in this permaculture path or whatever, you know, we're just like trying to remember stuff our grandparents told us.
Yeah.
You know, how to do things.
Make me think of, and this is rural again, but remember years ago there was a guy called Jerry Baker. You'll still see things. Because you'll find these old books around. Sometimes if you look at his books. He was a gardener, and he used, like, the vinegar and different kinds of soap and this to get rid of all kinds of bugs and to make your plants grow. I mean, he was just... you know, Mr. Green Thumb with using household, usually liquids, beer, whatever, to do all these things with. And it's true. You don't have to go out and be, you know, number one consumer and buy all this crap that, you know, the corporations are putting out.
That's a real serious philosophical point, and it's something Brett and I talk a lot about, is reversing your mind of consumerism, you know, kind of rethinking things, because we're used to consumables. We're used to, like, we're trying to deal with water filtration issues. How are we going to deal with that without being a consumable situation? And that is, you know, part of this process, the permaculture concept philosophically is, you know, reversing in your head, oh, I've always done it this way, but this is the consumer way to do it. And now I'm going to come up with, yes, I might have to get some supplies here and there, but go way further with it so that you don't have to go back to the store or go back to the consumer way of doing things.
You know how to, with filtering water, you know how to make your own activated charcoal, right? Have you ever tried that?
No,
have I ever told you how to do
what
it?
We're going to have to learn to do because we are.
It's very
we
easy.
Have the water, and I come from going to an artesian well all the time to Texarkana.
Let me tell you how to do
chewy.
This.
Oh my God!
You are going to love it. It's so simple. And being a hobby weird nerd, you're going to like the chemist part of it. It's fun. You go to your local hardware store. And you get a bag of lime that you would buy, crushed limestone that you would buy for your garden. And it'll take you forever to go through it. I've filled up a 5-gallon bucket. I've made tons, and I still have tons. And then you go and you get muriatic acid. Muriatic acid is, you can buy at any hardware store. It's hydrochloric acid. It's like, I think, 60%. It's used to clean concrete. And you can get a small can like you would a can of mineral spirits. You don't use much. You take the limestone and the hydrochloric acid, which is muriatic acid, and you mix them in proportion. And small, like you would pour, like, say, if I took a small, I took a regular size mason jar, you know, a quart, and I filled like an inch in the bottom with acid. And then I would spoon in limestone and just let the reaction take. It'll foam. It'll look like, you know, your stupid high school or, you know, elementary school project with a volcano, you know, baking soda and vinegar. It'll foam. You stay away from that because that is an acid reaction. But what you're doing is once it's done, you've made calcium chloride. It's a yellow liquid. You pour off the liquid. And you throw away, you know, you basically dump the old limestone, which is acidified limestone. You could put that in your garden in, like, a back area. It'll work into the ground, and it's not going to kill anything. It'll change the pH a little bit in that spot till the water had, you know, basically reverted it back to neutral. So that calcium chloride, you then take... And you mix it a quarter, you know, 1 to 4 with distilled water. That solution is what you soak your charcoal in. And you can make your charcoal from anything. You buy it. You could, you know, like I've bought charcoal. I've made my own charcoal. I got the same results, less labor because people did it for me. You know, and you can make charcoal real easy. You just burn wood and then bury it in sand and let it smolder. And you want to get the charred wood. The reason why activated charcoal works is, oh, well, first off, then you soak that charcoal in a sealed bucket of that solution for a day.
Uh-huh.
Take it out, dry it off, let it air dry. And pulverize it to a powder or however you need to fit it, and you pour your water through that. It will. That's activated charcoal.
Wow.
It takes a couple days to make because the process is. And I'll. I can write this down with that if you want
to
post it.
I want the Brita Water Company then, huh? I want all my salt to the corporation of the Brita Water Filter up here.
Yeah, you don't have to. I cleaned the water in my farm with this, and
wow.
I started. We were cleaning our house water, but I got an RO unit now. So, like, I was fine. That's really the best way to go. But this will work, and all you got to do is just, you need to keep this in, you know, basically, you know, once you rinse it, powder it, and get it ready, you know, you want to run some test runs of your water through it. And you look for the pH. Your pH of this should be low. It should be like 5.8, 6, something like that. You could do that with a litmus paper from, you know, a pool store. And just make sure that distilled water has a low pH. It's acidic. So you want to shoot for, if you're seeing it around 6, you're filtering your water. And then if you want to look, if you get like a good monitoring system, you check for your dissolved solids and your dissolved oxygen. And if you want to really make your water rock, get a fish tank aerator and put bubbles in your water because it oxygenates the water. The bubbles don't just float through and come out the top. No, the oxygen stays in the water. So you'll pull your pH back up with that, and you can get it roughly a high 6 at that point. And so then you got this distilled water that's oxygenated, and it costs you nothing, really. I mean, a fish tank aerator can cost like $5-$10. It takes millivolts to run it. And you can...
If you will write all this down and send it to me, we'll put it up online.
I was just thinking that. Like, this needs to say, like, and you know what I did was I pieced together a bunch of different things that I found on YouTube, and I found them in prepper sites. But nobody, they said, just mix calcium chloride. And I'm like, well, where do I get calcium chloride? And I realized that was kind of hard to find. So then I looked up how to make it, and there was this high school science project, how to make calcium chloride. Some kid was doing it. And I'm like, there you go. So then I did it and realized it worked really, really well. And then the aerating your water was something we found at the farm later. It was just a little trick that a lot of hydroponic growers and aquaponic growers use to get their water having all the nutrients you want. And the key thing is oxygen. That's crucial for plants. So, but and we found out while doing it that it changed the pH. So it actually brought our pH back up without having to do anything. So there were no chemicals involved. It was really an awesome find. And but yeah, then you can use it. Like I took a 5-gallon bucket and I went to the hardware store and bought a shower drain. And I basically cut the bottom of the bucket, mounted the shower drain, and then on the bottom of that I hooked up, glued some fittings and made a connectable bottom so that I can have just a very, you know, like a 3/8 piece of tubing that goes to one of those, you know, big giant water jugs. And then I pour the water through the top. Oh, and on top of that shower drain, I had a Brillo pad. And then what I did is I took that charcoal and I wrapped it in a T-shirt. You want a very porous cotton fiber that's unbleached. And I wrapped it in the T-shirt, and then I put a Brillo pad on top of that so I caught any, like, larger particles. So basically, no charcoal ran out, and I have, like, nasty well water. You know, it's very irony. And I was getting, I have, like, people compliment us on our water when they come here. Mm-hmm. And then I started doing it out of the RO unit. Because, well, you know, same job, it's easier. But, yeah, that's it, man. And that is your Brita filter in a nutshell. And
it costs
about $15 to build and about $10 for a supply that'll last you maybe a year, maybe 6 months, depending on the amount of water you filter. And depending on the type of filter you make, too, you know. I mean, like, I made a big one, you know, because I had a lot of people drinking water. But, like, for you guys...
Did you guys shower in it and bathe in it and stuff?
No. I like using the well water. As far as getting into weird energy things, I think that the iron is very, very integrated in why we don't have a million possessions on this high energy spot. That's me being weird. But I'm not the only. Me and Angel both, and a bunch of actually this guy I ran into recently that lives out by you, Karen. Wes Anik, he liked our theory too, because it's the rusty iron. That's an old Vedic thing that you use that to prevent possession, prevent bad energy coming in. And Well, we
yeah,
live on an
we
iron.
Have very irony, we have very irony soil right here, and it feels pretty good.
I would shower in it. I'm. The funny thing is, it will redden things, and you got to fight that. But me and Julie both are pretty much like, I like this, and it's just a weird feeling. I got nothing behind it yet, other than theories. And right now, I don't have a reason to stop it. But I wash my dishes in it. I just don't cook with it. I don't ingest it because it tastes like crap. It's good for you though. Like, it's not gonna kill you, but it tastes like crap. And even the bacteria that eats rust that lives in the bottom of most wells really isn't that bad of a bacteria. It's not gonna get you.
And you're making a good point on the urban, like bringing it back to the urban thing, is that, like, just how we get our water, we're getting it in pipes that are at right angles and stuff. And I learned from, learning a little bit about Victor Schauberg and what he was talking about water, is that there's now, like, Dan Winters and Imploder and some people working on how to improve the quality of water in a modern setting. We don't necessarily have to be very primitive with all of this. There is actually now technology developing. And then just that getting that awareness, feng shui kind of stuff, where I was talking to an architect, and their concept was to take a person's building and do as much as they could to an existing structure that was already there to make it more energy efficient with, this knowledge that's really becoming available on how to do water systems, how to do, they filtered their water on the roof with a grass layer, like grasses on the roof to help filter the water. And, of course, they worked on the energy efficiency of the windows coupled with solar panel technology and, didn't hugely change the space except to just be in an urban setting, start to bring these ideas in,
One of the things with the right angles, like, you might get some people that say that's kooky. Energetically, there's components, but there is also a very larger mechanical component, and it's absolutely mechanical chemistry, and that is that when you don't have clean flow, look at any river where there is a nook or a corner, you have stagnant water. Well, that is also the case in corners, and what happens is you end up with saltification and buildup, and that buildup then affects the water passing it after that, too, when the buildup gets tall enough. So you end up with a chemical reaction inside of there with this solvent dumping its minerals at the corner at this 90-degree angle. It's cutting around the corner, but it's slamming and packing salt into that corner. Ultimately affects the pH. It ultimately affects what deposits when your pipes go down. When your water gets cut off for whatever reason, you shut off and you're not pressurized, all that packed in salt and rust and crap then just gets stirred up because the water kept it packed and it's just skimming it off. And remember, crystals grow too. I mean, they grow on their own too. So like it gets pretty nasty. And then you cut the pressure off, it all falls down. And then you hit the pressure back up, and you just sent it in bulk right to the head of your faucet. So when you shut your water off for something, and you hadn't done it in a while, and you turn it back on, you're going to end up with massive buildup of shit you don't really want to ingest in bulk, like rust and salts and calcium and fluoride, and whatever is in your water, chlorine.
Well, if you recall our family, Ken Rickett is our family, when we had the Nisqually earthquake and we had my parents and my grandmother and myself all living in the triplex out in Washington State, after the Nisqually quake, we had all that sediment shook up through the pipes. The whole entire, apartment complex was one unit, and it did proper things and stayed structurally sound, but oh my God, when it shook out of our water pipes between the well head and the house, it's like we didn't drink that for a while, but that's what you're talking about, is all that stuff got shook out of the pipes.
It kicks it up. It's similar, take it, fracking on a small level. Fracking does the same thing. It stirs up what was packed by the pressure of the water, by the pressure of the ground, by the pressure of all this. They go in there and they're blasting this water in there and they're kicking all this stuff up. It gets in the water table where it's free to move. That's your house does the same thing, and we'll call it a micro scale compared to that, you know. But that's, you know, if anyone ever gets kooky with you about, you know, I'm a firm believer, though, that there is a lot to do with centrifugal force on water.
Having
curvature and flow and the energy in it. And I've got a lot of crap that could back that, but if anyone argues with you and you don't want to get into the weird metaphysical stuff, you just tell them, you know what, dude, this
it's
is why you don't want
it. It doesn't have to be metaphysical. It's actually physical.
No.
Physical.
Yeah, it's enough of an argument to get someone to consider thinking about it at least. But, yeah, with urban, to really, like, it's funny, the off-griddingness is really not as crazy as you would think. By the way, here's another one. I got a buddy that just invented a solar generator. I think I talked about it last time. And I maybe not, but I realized we did the measurements. This thing will run 3 houses of power.
Wow.
And it is 1 inverter, 1 battery, and 2 panels. And it's in a cart the size of a wagon. And there's no noise. And all he does is he stores up energy and then uses it. If you live efficiently, something like this works very well. You know, and if you want to overproduce, well, you know what? It cost him $3,000 to build it. It's not tied to his power system, so therefore, it's not illegal to have it. He didn't have to pay a licensed guy to install it. He's asking $5,000 for parts and labor for this thing that you pull around like a wagon, and it's about 100 pounds, and you put your panels wherever you want. And, you know, it's the same concept as having a trailer. It's not illegal because by code it's not attached to the building.
Well, it'd be sort of similar to a gas-powered generator. It's just solar-powered because they have wheels and they're like a cart and everything. And
here's
the
beauty of this. He priced it according to its comparable backup gas-powered generator.
Yeah.
And the battery has 800 hours of life on it. These are all things he bought in the store, you know. It's nothing crazy. He just came up with this idea of putting them together. And the inverter, everything, it's you put it in the garage, you know, run extension cords. We were running a phone charger, an air compressor, a skill saw, and a drill, and there was no fluctuation in the power. Now, a skill saw will dim the lights in your house. So we had a meter on it, and it, like, hopped for a second and was right back up when I hit the skill saw because its initial is really high, its initial power yank. But then after it regulates, which is, you know, milliseconds, it's normal. But everything else didn't affect it at all, not even the air compressor, which usually will do that.
Wow.
And this is a guy – oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, what's really great about that is that we had a couple of years ago in Washington State, we had a massive windstorm, a lot of lines down, a lot of trees down, and as it happens on the radio, two gentlemen who had gone through Hurricane Katrina, so they were really, you know, hot on it for how to practically find information. So one of the things that they did on that show was try to tell people which gas stations had power and they could get gas from because people were, it was a long enough outage for people to where they ran out of gas for their generators, even though they thought they had enough, like 3 days, 3 ways.
Wow.
This was a 4 or 5 day disaster, particularly in the outlying areas, you know, because it took a long time for the power crews. They brought power crews in from 4 states up there to deal with this massive outage. And then it became a problem because the gas stations themselves had power outages, so the pumps couldn't provide the gasoline, you know, for people to get it. So one of the things these guys did was getting everyone to report in which gas stations were open and had power and could provide gas for generators. So what you're talking about is a situation where that would not even be an issue.
That's,
you know,
not only was it not an issue, there's another thing with generators, why I liked it, because, like, for construction, there's usually a sound ordinance in most neighborhoods. 6
yeah.
o'clock, your generator has to be off.
Right.
Oh,
this, no
okay.
one even knows you're running it. There's no noise. It has no moving parts. It just is there. You just plug it in. It's
you want to hear something
beautiful.
Crazy, too, is the noise of the generator attracts thieves, and they'll steal the generators. That was another thing that people found was that it blew out.
I can attest to that. That happened to me,
yeah.
too. This when I was flipping homes, that became a real dilemma. They'd realize
yeah.
you're working on a house. They would come in and steal all the copper, and it would keep happening.
Yeah.
And so you couldn't even work with generators out there unless you muffled it down in the basement, because if
yeah.
they knew you were working on a house, they would sneak in at night when you weren't there. And this was
yeah,
common.
Or they just come
this
take the generator
the
either. They would come, I mean, they're a couple. They're really expensive, so they would just come take the generator
uh-huh.
as well.
I
that,
had a generator
was, you know,
stolen. It was like 100, yeah. and about $300 generator was gone. I'm like, what? You know, it happens.
Wow.
But, like, this thing is expensive, but it'll run everything. And the why you want such a high amount of power is because you have to have that backup stored so that you got power through the night, you know, and into the next
yeah.
day. So you want to have as much power produced as you're consuming, or a good flux, you know, like, you know, a good fluctuation of that. And it was just a brilliant thing, you know. This guy, he just came up with it one day and built
oh, well,
it.
Please put that somewhere. Post that somewhere.
He isn't ready to make
to
it beyond public and me talking about it, but I'll tell you this, Karen, he's moving out by you in a few months, and
oh,
I've already told
know.
Him about you. Yeah. I've already told
other,
him about you.
The other thing, too, is that my daughter, who's disabled, is now medically dependent on an airbed. She needs an airbed that
oh, yeah, you told me about that.
So
yeah.
I have actually been in the early stages of starting an organization to get backup power for people who are medically needy on equipment that has to run. I've run into that before with her. Fortunately, you know, I was able to go somewhere where there was power, stay with a family, you know, member when I needed power. She hasn't always been 100% medically needy, but now she is, as well as a lot of other people. And this just, you know, if I got to solve a problem for her, because I'm going to be...
You wouldn't need backup power
here.
If you just powered
absolutely.
It by this system.
Yeah, that is
it would never go down.
Because, which is really important, because some people, they're not going to breathe. They're, you know, very medically needy on some kind of backup system. And a
we're
going
to have to remember to get back on this. Like, just do not let me forget to... talk to him about this, and like, because I'm helping him basically figure out what to do with this thing. He invented it, and he was just thinking just for his
oh,
house.
I got a use for him.
Oh my God,
a use for
I
him.
Mean, he is awesome. Just one of the most giving people too. Just a really nice guy. So, yeah, that was really really weird. Thank you for steering this
well,
over to
know,
there.
Well, you know, it's a synchronicities kind of thing, but this is what
yeah.
we're learning to do. And this now you're talking about something that can be used in an urban setting. It's not. It's going to be, you know, for a lot of reasons, because I want to stay on the urban thing. I know, like I said, we're doing the rural thing, but, you know, really it's about human systems of all the things that we use. We've got to rethink as a society all these pieces.
Yeah, yeah. Starting with your basic components, you know, and then going backwards. Like, one of the big ones, too, what I was looking at, which we talked about a lot with this, was, you know, the fact that you're trying to basically remove yourself from the system of money. And
mm-hmm.
to go into living sustainably in an urban setting, you're absolutely making yourself undependent. Independent is good, but undependent. You're never needing to go back to money in an urban setting, which is, you know, like a very, very tricky, tricky thing when, you know, it's 90% of the community when
yeah.
going down. I mean, you want to see post-apocalyptic, you know, stuff. You know, people running around with mohawks and spears on motorcycles. And
Mad Max.
You know, yeah, total Mad Max stuff. You need to be in the city, you know. It's not going to happen where I'm at. Everyone out here
yeah.
has guns and chickens and pumps and wells. And, you know,
yeah.
we're just helping each other, like, get more efficient with it. But, and everyone tells me when, you know, when the shit hits the fan, I'm coming to your house. I'm like, yeah, I'd love to see
yeah.
you make it out of where you're at. Cause
yeah,
nobody,
that's the other
like,
thing, yeah.
you know, you're going to have to figure it out on your own in the hole. And like, I look at this when I say, like, you know, urban setting, I'm like, okay, someone lives in an apartment. How do you live efficiently in an apartment? Well, I will tell you one of the big ones. Okay, so you got a porch, and you're up on the 10th floor. Let's say you bought this solar generator. Okay, so now what you would do is you would run your cords. You would keep this generator, you know, it's safe in the house. So you keep it in the house, and you run cords and have the panels on your porch. You can keep it in a closet. Some of those porches have utility closets. Keep it in the utility closet. And you keep it there, and then you just pipe cords, and you can run everything in your house off that if you're not allowed to rig all your ceiling lights and rig all your, you know, your fans and things. Mm-hmm. Power strips. Get them into the house. You know, there's ways around the code without even damaging the apartment, and you can rig that to come through. Even in the dead of winter, you can have an extension cord. You can find a way to sneak it into the house. And you have this.
I don't think they're going to get after you for that if you've got a way to provide for yourself, because they've got, you know, 100 other people screaming at them at that point.
Exactly, and that's the thing. So now you got power. And the other one, when in an apartment, and this is the one that scares me more than power. Power was a big one. It affected people because they were all hot. Oh, big whoop, you know. But in the winter, people die. You know, so that I get nervous about. Like in New York, you know, we go back to that scenario when they power went out for, what, 3 days? And,
yeah,
or 5 days.
Hurricane Sandy.
3 days.
Was, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what was the thing that collapsed first? Water. Water supply
was
gone.
Yeah.
And that's the thing nobody thinks about, is storing water. Well, okay, so why did water go out? Well, first off, the power went out, so the water company had no way to pump. So they could not pump water. Okay, so here you are. You're on the 10th floor in an apartment complex. You're never going to be fully off-grid from water. So what I looked at is, like anybody, store your water. Also, like that is going to be your break point. You can get by without power. You can make your own power in an apartment. You can grow your own food on that same porch and in that front, that sliding glass window, or all your south-facing windows. You can grow your own food with the lights powered by the solar generator. You know, it makes enough power to run a full farm. My farm, producing 40,000 heads of lettuce a month, used 22 kilowatt hours a day of power. This thing produced 12.
Wow.
So that's insane. You know, I'm talking, I had 200 banks of LED fluorescent lights. Yeah, like you could produce power for three households with this thing.
Yeah. Well, no, the
and
water
you go
thing,
in on it.
Yeah, like FEMA,
the water
like
thing
when you see a disaster, that's the first thing they have to set up is some way to get blocks of ice or water. That's like the first thing, nearly, that they
yeah,
have to
Yeah, and you have to, stuff. Like, that is the big one that people need to pay very close attention to, is that you should be storing water in your house and rotating it. So, like, like the way I look at it is this. I always drink from a water jug. And what I would do is keep a cabinet that was just water jugs, and I would put them in on the right and pull from the left and just slide them over. You fill them up, put them in the fridge or on the counter or wherever, you know. And so that way there's a rotation of clean water. And then the big one you do is if you're on city water, you better be filtering it. So make your own charcoal filter.
Mm-hmm.
Filter it yourself. Now at least you've got that. But when it ultimately breaks down, you need to have a water collection system. If it breaks down, now I'm not a big fan of that actually occurring, but sustainability is being off the grid or not tied to the grid. That is your break point in an urban setting.
Or having backup
is another thing. The backup, like this, that was backup right there. You know, most people should consider it. And it's just a laziness factor. I'm not even going to say laziness. It's a distraction factor. We get distracted from the processes we try and set up. I had to store water because I use a well and it doesn't taste good to drink. So I had to start making water. And it just came by default to do that.
Yeah, we're in the same situation now.
Yeah, and that's easy. But, like, you live in Chicago or in New York, and you're up in a high-rise. It's not. You pretty much set yourself up for a very hard time to get out of. And is that music?
Yes.
Lame.
1 minute to go.
Do you guys want to keep going on this? Because we just got to, like, I want to talk about the solution to this because I have no clue. I'm hoping we come up with one.
Next week we will have a solution. How's that?
I don't know. We'll have something.
Well,
all right. All right, guys. Cool.
Bye.
Bye.
See you then.
I'll talk to you.
Bye.